Well, hello and welcome, everybody. This is your host, Ken D. Foster, for the Voices of Courage show. Today, we're exploring the ideas, one of the voices, and the movements that are shaping the future of America. Today, we're talking about innovation, not just technology or invention, but the deeper creative force that drives progress, prosperity, and possibility. You know, America's always been fueled by imagination. Yet many believe that we're facing an innovation deficit, a slowing of creativity, ownership, and original thinking that threatens our long-term competitiveness and cohesion. True innovation does not begin in laboratories or boardrooms. It begins in consciousness. You know, ancient wisdom teaches us that creativity flows from awareness, intention, and actions that are aligned. When individuals and communities are connected to purpose, innovation accelerates naturally. And when we're disconnected, even with a lot of resources, okay, we fail to produce lasting results. We're going to explore the often overlooked history of innovators whose contributions have shaped entire industries, but were rarely acknowledged. I want to look also into how community-driven ecosystems and ownership and collaboration ignites creativity, especially within communities that have historically innovated out of necessity rather than out of creativity. So this conversation today, I'm hoping for you will ignite innovation within you, will ignite that creative energy that's already within you. But then, you know, a lot of times it's stifled, and we'll get into some of that today. But I just know this, you know, innovation begins with stillness. It's a place, yeah, stillness, right? Some of you go, what? Stillness, where you can just step back, tune into yourself, get aware. Maybe you just, you know, and I wrote a book 20 years ago called Ask and You Will Succeed, 1001 Extraordinary Questions, Ordinary Questions, actually, to create extraordinary creativity, to open up your creativity. And, you know, as you sit still, you begin to have these downloads, most of us do, of what next steps are. And, you know, if you spend a little time in that, you'll see what I mean. You know, creativity, I believe, flows out of alignment, not trying to force it. You know, some of you set goals and then push. Yeah, I did that when younger, and I sometimes do today. But most of the time, I just want to align with what is coming through in this stillness that I just talked about, right? And, you know, once I get it, though, once I get where I'm going or my clients get where they're going, then we apply the force. Then we apply willpower. Then we start to look at who we need to bring into the organization, who we need to, what systems we need in place, you know, what the plans are. You know, we start putting together, you know, business plans, marketing plans, you know, and start executing on that. But that's not where it all starts from. It starts from this stillness, this innovation. So, you know, all of you have multiple creative powers. And in my world, everybody has a one or two very unique gifts that you bring to the world. When you can figure out what that is and you bring in other people, places, and resources to really help you innovate, everything gets better and better for you. All right. I've got a very special guest today, so I don't want to take any more time on the in the intro. But what I'm going to do is take a quick break, and when I come back, we'll have my guest. Welcome back, everybody. I'm here with Dr. Roy Zwalin. Did I say that right, Roy?
Zwalin.
Thanks. Zwalin. I was close.
You're okay. You're close.
I was close. But anyway, Roy, welcome to the show. I feel very blessed to have you here today. And I know you got a new book out. So it's great to have you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm excited to talk and learn from you and share some of my thoughts as well.
That's how I feel the same way with you. So this is going to be a great conversation. You know, for those of you that don't know, I know my guest here. He grew up as a army brat in the Middle East, where his father's Arabic studies exposed him to a rich blend of cultures in Jordan, Turkey, Kuwait, and Syria. Educated in diverse international schools, Roy developed a global perspective that made returning to a divided America both enlightening and challenging. At BYU and later George Mason School of Law, he explored multiculturalism through political science, economics, and law. And after advising global biotech leaders and policymakers, he chose to build innovation infrastructure himself. And now, as the chief strategy officer of Elschleim, I got that wrong too. Innovation, he leads strategy, governance, and operations with global insight. Sometimes I just am not on with the names. I apologize,
It's
Roy.
okay. Yeah, we set you up a bit. It's Eshelman Innovation. So you are good.
Eshleman. Eshleman. Okay.
Eshelman, yep.
Eshleman. Okay. Eshleman Innovation. Yeah, now my audience has heard it a few times. They go, yeah, we know what that is. Okay, good. What is Eshleman Innovation? Let me just start there. What is that? What did you start?
I'm happy to talk about that. So Fred Eshelman, it's named after the donor to UNC Chapel Hill. He dedicated a $100 million gift, one of the largest in the university's history, to focus on getting the great research and some early stage technologies out of the university and impacting patients. And so Eshelman Innovation sits inside the UNC Eshelman School of Pharmacy, which is a bit of a unique place for it to sit. But Eshelman wanted it to be very close to the cutting edge therapeutics and digital health technologies that are being developed here. And Eshelman Innovation not only gives out grants and funding to great innovators, but we go right alongside and help them build the ventures together. We do that together, and we bring capital in, we bring industry expertise in to really de-risk these early stage technologies, make them really market oriented, which will then translate into being patient oriented and get past that perennial problem that we sometimes have in academia of getting past the publication, right? We can publish great knowledge, but if we can't implement it, if we can't take that great science and turn it into technologies that are relevant for patients that doctors want to use, right? That actually improve outcomes for patients and therefore can and should be rewarded financially. That's our focus every day.
Is innovation being stifled today, especially in the medical industries? Is it being stifled? Is it kind of shutting down? I mean, there are too many regulations and whatnot going on that seem to stop, or maybe too many multinational companies involved with too many politics that are hurting this. What's your thought on this?
Yeah, the healthcare industry, life science is a very interesting sector. It is a heavily regulated sector, and it should be, right? To some extent, these are medicines and other kinds of technologies that are going to be used on patients, right? It's used for health, and so that should be appropriately protected and watchguarded by government agencies and by others, and those things matter. So I don't want to downplay the importance of some of those protective measures that every country needs to have. Now, having said that, it's not always rationally aligned with where the innovation is. It's often catching up to the new science, new technologies that are being developed every day in across academia and small startups and even large companies. And so there's a how do we keep regulations up with the emerging innovation and technologies problem. There is sometimes a big and small problem too, is if you have large incumbents and you have that problem, as you always do with incumbents, in which innovation, particularly disruptive innovation, is designed to help shift into new spaces. And so that is certainly a big variable. But oftentimes, there's just the uncertainty of whether or not the technology will work, right? And how do we actually make the science better? How do we actually bring capital and talent together in ways that really accelerate the change and really capture the opportunity. So that's how I think about it, is this is about opportunity that's just sitting there on the factory floor that we just need to capture.
Well, as experts in innovation, I've read that you've observed it. You know, you guys did observe and you took a deep dive into the AA community. Can you share little thoughts on that? What was the results of that? I'm very curious to that.
Yeah. So this was in the kind of George Floyd era. We took a step back, just like everybody did, just to kind of understand our own blind spots and try to understand what we could do differently or better where are we not looking that we should be looking. And we, being in North Carolina and in the South, the African American community was an obvious place to kind of look, given the national politics at the time and where we are located in this Rust Belt, in this area where, you know, the vast majority of African American population still lives. And we talked to our co-authors that are on this book that are from that community and got excited about looking at, again, the opportunity. So much of the conversation that was going on nationally and even still today was about, appropriately so, justice and other kinds of frameworks and conversations. But as innovators, we want to take a step back and say, well, where's the hidden opportunity? And where are we not looking? And that we should be looking. That's central to every venture capital thesis, right? That we are going to go find those startups and invest in those startups that are hidden from the world right now. And we're going to help them grow. So we took that mindset into the African American community and looked at the history of innovation in that community in the United States. And we're inspired, frankly. And that in spite of all the barriers, there's some great entrepreneurs and great innovators. And we wanted to bring that to the forefront and to the spotlight to see what, not only what we could learn, we share our reflections as people not from the community of what we're learning about innovation, about entrepreneurship from in a space where it's really hard to do that with all the barriers in that community. And what are the opportunities going forward that we should engage in?
Well, I love that. You know, I took a trip to India last year, and this is hopefully disrespectful to the Indian nation. But when I was there, you know, I have an eye as an entrepreneur, and I looked around and I went, oh my gosh, almost everything needs improvement here. This is like entrepreneur's paradise. So, you know, but I see that differently than I'm sure people that live in the country. And as you're going into the AA community, you're probably seeing things that maybe the community's not seeing. You're going like, there's so much opportunity here. Is that what I'm hearing?
That was, I mean, we were, you know, to kind of speak to the elephant in the room, you know, there was this frame of, okay, well, why is this, you know, white male, like really diving into this space? And what is it, you know, why, you know, what, and there was this interesting dialogue, and we kind of asked that question, like, should we be telling these stories? And they said, no, absolutely you should, because what they were, again, the conversation was appropriate around justice, but nobody was coming in and saying, oh, wow, there's like, we should be investing in this community. We should be investing in India because there's all these great opportunities for real financial returns. Yeah. And so the feedback from our co-authors and others is that, like, nobody really talks to us this way as people that want to come in as partners and actually invest in us because of the opportunity and not just because we're trying to just set right past wrongs. That's still, there's a place for that. That still needs to happen. But it was a different conversation. And I think the reception we received from the community and other communities that we've engaged with this mindset has been incredibly positive.
I love that. That's great. Well, I got to take a quick break. I'm going to put the book on the screen before we take a break so you can, my audience can see what we're talking about. It's Race to Innovation. And it's a fascinating, I love our discussion. And when we get back, we're going to take a deep dive into some of the benefits that you'll receive when you read this book, and it helps you to really get a different take, a different perspective, different mindset on how to innovate. So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will discuss that.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back, everybody. This is your host, Ken Foster, and I'll be right back with my guest in just a moment. I did want to mention to you, if you're on YouTube right now, please click the subscribe button, and that way you won't miss any shows, and you'll be able to pass them on to people that you love and care about, of course. And if you're not on YouTube, you can go to see our shows there, all of our shows there, and both of our Voices of Courage and Heal It shows at youtube.com/@TheCourageNetwork. That's youtube.com/@TheCourageNetwork. All right, I'm back here with my guest, Roy. And you got his new book out, which is Race to Innovation. And we're going to talk about that in just a second. But I wanted to ask you something else. You know, tell me about some of the history of the Black innovators, because you took the deep dive in the community. I'm curious.
Okay. I'd love to. Yes. So two stories that were kind of early for us, but really transformative. The first is Sarah Breedlove. You may know her as Madam C.J. Walker. There's been some recent movies about her and her great story. What people may not realize is that she's the first member of her family born in the late 1860s, right after slavery ends. So she's born free. But she has all of the kind of what in healthcare we would say all the social determinants of negative outcomes that end up having to her. She's orphaned at 7. She's married at 14. She has her first child at 18. Her husband dies at 20 years old. She moves, you know, she's in the South. She moves to be closer to her brothers to get some support. She's doing laundry. She works as a laundress for a period of time. And she had this problem that, you know, every entrepreneur ends up starting with, where her, due to bad nutrition and lack of clean water, her hair started falling out in clumps. And, you know, she tried everything that was available. It wasn't working. And so she had to invent her own solution. And so she went through that process and invented her own solution that worked for her. And she happened to be connected to another entrepreneur at the time in the beauty business, who's also African-American female, Annie Turnbow Malone. And she kind of taught her the business ropes. And ultimately, Sarah Breedlove, or Madam C.J. Walker, as she renames herself later on in life, goes on to become America's first female self-made millionaire. So not first Black self-made female self-made millionaire, first female self-made millionaire, period. And it was because of this entrepreneurship. She went out west and launched this beauty empire. And all of these positive effects happened. She created all these jobs for African-American women. She supported the NAACP and actually funded a lot of their anti-lynching efforts at the time. And it's kind of this important figure in our history. And she had this massive impact. And if you were to look at where she started, you know, people like yourself or me or your audience would have never guessed that she would have been that successful, right? And that there's something powerful about innovation and entrepreneurship that unlocked that opportunity for her that we all can learn from. In spite of the barriers, she was successful. So what can we learn in that way?
Well, I love that. And so is that story in the book?
It is, yes.
Okay. Yeah. So it's in the book, Race to Innovation. And by the way, why did you write the book? What was the background on that?
Yeah. So I talked a little bit about this before, but it really was this frame of coming out of the George Floyd moment and trying to understand, you know, taking a look at ourselves. But yeah, as we got deeper, you know, time kind of went on. Most people kind of moved on, quite frankly, from the George Floyd piece. A lot of great books came out at that time. But we kept going because, again, it was we're missing an opportunity. We're trained as innovators and entrepreneurs to see problems, right, and see opportunities. And we started thinking, well, what in these communities can we start engaging with? And we started bringing our own Eshelman Innovations, own innovation playbooks and platforms to these communities, whether it was the African-American community, or even out in Western North Carolina and Appalachia, to kind of the more poor white rural communities out there, to really try to find, again, these hidden opportunities, this hidden expertise, this hidden talent, and really try to capture these opportunities, right? That, and it's not just charity, right? We're coming in as investment partners and bringing our own infrastructure, bringing our own people, and treat them as partners. And so the book is really about all of these stories and history that we just love in the African-American community, and the principles that we learned from that, and how we applied that towards the end of the book for ourselves. But it really is this frame of kind of, to your point, starting in stillness. We wanted to do the same thing and take a step back, stop running around, take a look at the problem with fresh eyes, bring our innovation entrepreneurship frameworks and playbooks to the table and see what we could come up with.
You know, it's so me, and I'm so glad you're doing this with this book. But you know, when I look at African American community, I look at our Chinese American community, Japanese American community, the Native Americans, and you know, we have so many innovators that are just we just haven't talked about their stories yet. They just haven't been into the mainstream media. For whatever reason, I don't care what the reason is, but you know, when we start to understand, we're really bringing in this nation, even though we're going through some turmoil, but what we'll end up with is a nation where we understand that we are all one. We are all connected here. And you know, when we can start to embrace that in a much greater way, instead of it's me against you and I did this and you did that and you know, you owe me this. That crazy talk, you know, that old competitive ego stuff, we really start to come from a place of understanding and tap into the wisdom that, like, you've tapped into the innovators here,
right?
Through story. And I love story because that's how we learn. We have a bright future. That's what I know. Can you share one of those stories, like the current stories of Black innovators that you have in the book?
Yeah, I'll do one of my favorite, and someone that might be more well known, Rihanna Fenty. Right? For those of you that like music, that's going to be familiar to you. What you may not know is that Rihanna Fenty is actually the youngest female self-made billionaire in the United States. Again, not the first Black female, not the youngest Black female, the youngest female self-made billionaire. And that was because of her beauty brand. You may know Fenty Beauty is the name of her beauty brand. And it's the cosmetic industry, you may know, is a $49 billion market in the United States. And it's been, at the time, they were doing what a lot of large organizations will do, is they're trying to bring down costs, right, and create efficiencies. And what that resulted in was very limited, a handful of makeup foundation options for consumers. Rihanna realized that it certainly didn't match her skin tone. It certainly didn't match a lot of African-American skin tone, but it was a common problem across all people. It did match most white women's. So even majority populations, the product wasn't actually serving the market. And so she launched, based on her brand and based on her kind of her career and her visibility, she launched her own beauty brand, and she came out, instead of a handful of foundations, she came out with 40 foundations, 40 different foundations to cover every skin tone that they could cover. And that's what made her a billionaire. And it moved the entire cosmetic industry from, again, 4, maybe 5 foundation options to 40 foundation options. So this unique insight buried in this community that nobody's paying attention to, innovation and entrepreneurship come along and completely change an entire industry.
That's so cool. I love that story. Yeah, that's, it just reminds me, I'm sitting here looking at a doorknob in my office thinking, you know, somebody's going to reinvent that in using AI or something. And it's going to be a lot easier to, you know, I'll look at the door and it'll open or something, you know. We got so many ways to innovate, and there's so many opportunities for people out there. I think we just have to look at people in a different way. I know that you have a unique way of defining minority communities. So I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah. So we use the broadest definition possible. And so that's why I mentioned our activity kind of in white rural America, right? So that's a minority. We think about it in diverse training as well, right? That there's other people that think differently than you, whether, you know, because I'm a lawyer and you're a business strategist, Ken, right? And so we have different backgrounds and trainings.
Yeah.
And all of this kind of building off to what you're saying about what can we do in America to think differently about people certainly understanding them, but I would also argue, how do we actually value people, right? Like, how do we actually see people as potential valuable partners that can benefit us, right? So moving from a competitive frame to that you laid out to this, wow, together we can create incredible value. We can create this, you know, self-made billionaire Rihanna opportunities if we partner with people and bring different skill sets and different lived experiences together in unique ways. What is the innovation that could come out of that? What are the entrepreneurial opportunities? And then once we created great value, then we can figure out how to capture it and divide up the pie, right? Like we can get to that, right? That's important. And we talk about some of those principles necessary for that. But again, we have to create value before we worry about competing.
Well, I think to create value too, I'll just throw this out there, is one needs to know yourself. You got to know yourself, okay? Because, you know, if you don't know yourself, if you really think that, you know, you really are your accomplishments, you know, yeah, this, look at me, I've accomplished this, I've got a, yeah, I'm driving my Ferrari, or I'm driving my, you know, whatever, you know, my big truck, or I, you know, or I have this beautiful wife, so I must be my wife and my accomplishments. And I have all these beautiful children. Well, that's who I look at. How great. When we get rid of all that and we start to understand who we really are at the essence of ourselves, you know what? The essence of ourselves is really, and some people argue with me, especially people that are maybe going down a dark path, but at the essence of all of us is this thing called compassion and joy and love and happiness and power and wisdom. It's all in there.
Yes.
A lot of people just don't remember it.
Yes. Well, the beauty of that, Ken, and I love what you're saying, is when we do that well, then we can start doing that with other people well too. And that's exactly how you can scrape away kind of the things that may either be meaningless or are very superficial, right? To categorize some of the things that you describe.
Yeah.
And say, oh, wow, like here's a person from a different community from me that is different. I know myself, and so I know that they're different from me. And this is how we could work together in really interesting ways that creates not only just the joy of innovating and being an entrepreneur, but real economic value, right? Like this is, I think most people think it's a trade-off, right? I either have to kind of go off and, you know, into the Himalayas and, you know, be rich or something to be able to afford that. But to your point, you could be still right here and there's real value that's created and driven in yourself and in the others that you're connected to.
Well, listen, a lot of people, and I, you know, I was guilty of this early on. I thought in terms of black and white, it's this way or that way. Okay. The trade-off, you know, if I'm going to pursue wealth, then I won't pursue a balanced life. I'm just going to make a bunch of money and I'll worry about my health later. And I'll worry about my spiritual life later. It's not that way. And yeah, I mean, it can be that way if you want it to be that way, but you know, I work with enough wealthy entrepreneurs, you know, famous wealthy, that, you know, they get up into their 50s and all of a sudden their health is going and they're spending a lot of money on it. And their relationships have been blown up. You know, they're not, you know, they're divorced. Their families are split up. A lot of things happen. So, you know, it's kind of like we got to have some balance here. Okay. But I did like, you know, there's a piece that, you know, innovation is the key, I think. You know, when we start getting out of there's nothing wrong with competition. I love competition. I'm a competitive athlete, right? I have been for many years. I love that. But it's not, my competition is about trying to tear down others or necessarily even beat others. My competition with our companies and with ourselves is to better ourselves, better our products, better our customer service, better it for, you know, and that's when we start to think in those terms, we can start becoming more inclusive because we're not in a place of fear-based, oh, they're going to invent something that we won't be able to keep up with. Yeah. Well, I look at Apple as like, Apple doesn't think like that. They just keep inventing, right?
Yeah, they keep going. Well, I love sports as well, and I'll use another example. You know, Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, the NBA would be nowhere without them. Right. We talk about Magic Johnson in the book, which is part of why I'm bringing him up and kind of his history around missing out on some entrepreneurial opportunities. But in particular, you know, it was that competitive spirit between Larry Bird and Magic Johnson. I think a lot of people would, I don't think I'm out on the limb on this, that created the value of the NBA that it is today. So, but it wasn't competition to destroy the other person. It was to build an overall opportunity, an overall market. And so to your point, we can be competitive and still be creating additional value. We can be growing a marketplace, right? And that's kind of a very maybe surface level example, but that's where we need to get to, right? This innovation entrepreneurship is about creating markets, and there's going to be competitors in that markets, but you can appropriately work and compete with competitors that builds a market rather than destroys a market.
100%. we're putting on the screen where one of the places you can get the book, Race to Innovation. You can go to racetoinnovation.net and you can get it there. Can you get it on Amazon too?
Yes, Amazon. You can, all of your favorite bookstores, you can order it online and they'll get it to you.
Okay, awesome. Well, I sure encourage my audience to go out and open up your innovation mind. And one of the ways we do that is through education. So I'm hoping they'll all go over there and check it out. All right. All right. So listen, I got to take a quick break. And when we get back, I got a question to ask you. I'll just pre-frame it so you know it's coming. You emphasize the importance of enclaves. What are they and what do they matter for innovation? So I'm just going to set that up and we will be right back after the break.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Ken D. Foster. I'm talking with author Ray Zwahlen. He's got his new book out, Race to Innovation, Unleashing the Power of Entrepreneurship for Everybody. And you can get it on Amazon or the racetoinnovation.net. And we hope you'll check it out. All right. So enclaves, what is that? What are we talking about here?
Yes. So enclaves are an underappreciated aspect of entrepreneurship. And, you know, let me start with a story because I think this is from our book that I think is helpful to describe it. So in the late 1800s in Wilmington, North Carolina, the African-American community coming out of slavery in 1860s was about 55% of the city of Wilmington. Wilmington, for those that don't know, is a major shipping port at the time. So lots of business coming in and out of that. And the you know, slavery ends and you've got 55% of the population of the city then are free. What they do is they dive into entrepreneurship. They start creating businesses, one of the first black newspapers, they're barbers, they become lawyers. And in the same generation, so former slaves go in the same generation from slaves to upper and middle class in society. Because, in our view, because of entrepreneurship and innovation, they take whatever skills they had, whatever skills they could learn, they launch businesses and they create this enclave in Wilmington. And what happens in these enclaves is that, you know, these are angel investors, right? They're investing in each other's businesses, their customers, their expertise are sharing across all these different domains and helping each other out. And there's psychological safety. There's been a lot of studies around this where, you know, innovation, entrepreneurship, you're often out on the limb and it takes things like stillness. But it also these support groups, if you will, right? This broader community around you that's going to help get you to where you want to go, that's to provide the resources, the expertise, the connections. And well, again, what's really interesting, this story, unfortunately, has a sad story, because in 1898, there was a coup d'etat in the region. And the Ku Klux Klan and kind of people that are supporting them burned down all the businesses. They murdered, you know, I think over 100 people, and the estimates are probably, it's probably higher, much like Tulsa in the Greenwood District, if you know about that. But what we loved about the story was that, again, kind of there's the justice side of this, and then there's the what can we learn on the opportunity side of this, and really asking the question, well, wait a minute, back up a little bit. It's still the South, right? It's still their banking. They did not have access to banking. They did not have access. They were kind of discriminated against to mortgages and loans. All these things were happening. And yet they built this incredible entrepreneurial enclave. They went from slavery to upper and middle class in the same generation. How many stories in history do we have like that? It's very few. And there's something about that community that is of people that are like-minded, that come together, that share culture and live experiences that is incredibly powerful.
Well, my suspect is if we were to study that group at that time and you were if you asked them about their mindsets, my guess is that they may use the burning down of the town, you know, as fuel, but I can guarantee that the ones that were the innovators were the ones that said, yeah, that's our past. We're moving on. We're not going to stay stuck in the past. We're not going to repeat that in our minds over and over and over again and tell a story and over and over again. We're going to move on. We're going to find the good in this. We're going to figure it out, and we're going to build out it. We're going to innovate and create something new. I've found over the years that there are certain people that just can't let go of the past, and they're stuck in the past, and they are not the innovators. The innovators are the ones that can let it go or use it. Yet, and they'd let go of the emotion around it, use the memory to fuel them so that that never happens again. Those are innovators.
And we saw that happen a bit. So Durham created it, that was the next iteration of the Black Wall Street in North Carolina.
Yeah.
And that one was not burned down ultimately, thankfully, and that continues to today. You know, Tulsa is in the 1920s, has a similar story, but theirs is burned down and they're just now trying to recover. But, you know, people will flee a region. And so, again, as partners, as people outside the community, it is how do we enable the innovators, as you describe them, right? Like, how do we actually understand and recognize the value of those enclaves? Think about how do we engage with those enclaves, whether it's the African-American community near you, or if you're a business person, if you're engaging with scientists, right, that might have a great technology they're developing, or engaging people in the, you know, in rural communities or whatever, these people that are different than you, that are a minority in your frame, that, you know, how do we take those lessons, find those people, find the opportunities, and again, recreate value. But again, those enclaves are important. So we have to understand not just how we engage with those enclaves, but also that, you know, you can't just create, you know, a version of a melting pot where the enclaves go away. The psychological safety and network and other things that are found in those enclaves are critical. And so we want to preserve, we want to maintain, we want to support those enclaves of people, because that's how they get over that risk taking. That's how they move beyond, right? That's how they move on, quite frankly.
And you know, today we might talk about it as a mastermind groups or advisory committees or, but within the enclave. Okay. So we have that within the enclave, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
All right. I got to take another break. We'll be back. I want to talk about ownership. You know, there's a recurring theme in your book, so I want to know about why is that so crucial to innovation. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. We are talking about the new book, Race to Innovation, and I've got the author with me today. Roy, there's that recurring theme, like I said, of ownership. What? Let's touch base on that a little bit. Got a couple of minutes here.
Yeah, I would love to, and I'll go back to Magic Johnson. So most people know that, basketball fans certainly know that He has the highest rookie contract ever coming out of college. There's famous stories with the LA Lakers about him threatening to go back to school if he doesn't get the contract he wants. It's lots of great stories. What people may not realize also that happened at the time was Nike, a relatively new company at the time, offered him a shoe endorsement deal. And rather than just giving a flat $100,000, that they were going to offer, they offered him a $1 royalty on every shoe sold, giving him effectively ownership, right? Part ownership in the company at least in this royalty sense, that he would capture, own the value that he was creating by his own brand. He turned it down. He said he had no idea what royalties were or stocks or ownership of any kind. And he took $100,000 from Converse instead. And the value of that $1 royalty by some estimates is worth $5 billion today. So that's and he talks about that being, you know, one of the worst kind of business mistakes that he made. Take Michael Jordan, right, whose mother, and there's a great movie about this too, actually understood the value of that and understood the value of the brand or the value that Michael Jordan was creating for Nike, and they negotiated that, and that's driven his wealth. It wasn't the basketball contracts, the salary, it's owning the value that he created. So we use this example, and there's additional stories in the book about the importance of not just us thinking about how do we ensure that we're capturing the value that we're creating, but as partners, as people outside the community, that we're thinking about that with other people too. How do we enable each other's ownership so that when we get to that point of creating massive value, hopefully, right, that on the other end, that value gets divided up and we're incented to engage with one another and not fall into some of those competitive traps that you were describing earlier on.
I love that. I love that. Negotiating a contract right now. And that's part of the deal. It's like, you know, if you want me, you got to give me ownership.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, we want to share in the upside, right? I think that's the, and that's a hard mindset for entrepreneurs. That's central to entrepreneurism, right? It's central to being an innovator is wanting to benefit from the results of your ideas and your work. And that's hard for people that work more in a corporate setting or used to salary, right? They don't understand how that works. And so it's not just educating yourself about capturing your own value, but actually entering into these relationships, particularly if they come from a minority community, because they're less likely to have the knowledge or skill sets to negotiate for themselves.
Yeah.
So we need to,
you know, it's also, there's another piece to that when you have ownership, you're committing to a long-term relationship.
That's right.
And, you know, I don't get involved in, short-term things. I just don't. You know, when it comes to business or owning a business or putting my time, my ideas and effort into something, it's a long-term commitment. So I'm spending time up front making sure that the values of the partners that I'm partnering with are aligned with my values and making sure that there's a whole bunch of things we can go into there. But, you know, the ultimate is that, yeah, I want a long-term relationship, you know?
Yep. That's how the best things are built. The best things in life are built that way. I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. They come with ownership. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm out of time, man. We could just go on and on and on about this. This has been really great. I want to put the book up on the screen one more time. It's Race to Innovation. I hope my audience will go out and go get that book. It's a good book. It's and thank you for your time today, Roy. I really appreciate it. RaceToInnovation.net is where you can go and get the book, or you can get it on Amazon too, I believe. Any final thoughts?
No, just a thank you, Ken. This has been a wonderful conversation. I hope it's been helpful for your audience too. And we'd love to, you know, move from that stillness place that you talked about, Ken, in the beginning, and really thinking about how can we extend this to others and bring other people in and really capture the opportunity of America. That's what I
love. That. Thank you, Roy. And thank all of you for joining us today. You know, if you continue to watch this show, you will be able to see the unseeable, know the unknowable, and do the impossible. Pass the show on to people you care and love about. Till next time, take care.